Reminiscing, I feel you near. Once more, you're my love of yesteryear.
Howdy, folks.
Yes, it is your old friend singing.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Lisa Maxwell for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading from Reminisce Magazine. Our first article is titled, Jazz Diplomacy, Louis Armstrong Spread the Message of Music, by Don Charles of Suwanee, Georgia. When I was 16, I met one of my musical heroes, Louis Armstrong, one of the all-time greats of jazz. The occasion was a concert given by Louis Armstrong and his All-Stars on November 24, 1956, at Muhlenberg College in Allentown, Pennsylvania. A junior at nearby Whitehall High School, I was sports editor of the school newspaper. Our faculty advisor knew I was into jazz and suggested that I'd interview Armstrong. My dad was active in many civic associations and knew the sponsors of the concert, so I was granted access to the band's dressing room. My favorite of Armstrong's albums was one he made a year earlier. Called Ambassador Satch, it was recorded in 1955 in Europe while Armstrong and his band were touring as cultural diplomats for the U.S. State Department. Showing how long he'd been making records, one of the songs on that album was a revival of West End Blues, which he first recorded to great acclaim in 1928. I started my interview by saying, Mr. Armstrong, I want to tell you that I'm collecting your records and I've been a fan of yours for a long time. He gave me a big smile and said simply, Thank you, Daddy. He talked about his early career and also told me he hoped to play in Russia. Unfortunately, that tour never materialized. He said he never took vacations and just wanted to make music. Meanwhile, my dad spotted a professional photographer he knew and talked him into taking a picture of me with Armstrong. My interview and the picture ran on the front page of the school paper. And here's some interesting facts about Louis Armstrong. He was born Louis Daniel Armstrong on August 4, 1901 in New Orleans, Louisiana, and he died on July 6, 1971 in Queens, New York. The career of the influential jazz trumpeter, vocalist, and composer spanned from the 1910s to the 70s. After his father abandoned the family, Armstrong was raised in poverty. He credited a period in juvenile detention where he took his first instrumental lessons for the pursuit of music. Armstrong's punishing schedule and dynamic technique caused chronic lip injury, a condition he treated with a special balm invented by a German trombonist. He endorsed the cream and tins were marked with Armstrong's name. He criticized President Dwight D. Eisenhower for doing too little about segregation, but later agreed to tour as a jazz ambassador for the U.S. State Department, and he is quoted as saying, "A note's a note in any language." Our front and center section shows a spotlight on Annette Funicello, who lived from 1942 to 2013. When Annette Funicello put on mouse ears for the new Disney variety show, Mickey Mouse Club, she quickly became the favorite of the ensemble. She got her own spin-off series, Annette, in 1958, taking the first steps toward a recording career with the hit, How Will I Know My Love? She traded the ears for a bikini in several beach party musicals with Frankie Avalon, achieving peak fame as a teen queen. Through it all, Funicello maintained a sterling reputation as the modest girl next door. Walt spotted her at the ballet. Funicello was born into a blue-collar Italian-American family in Utica, New York, and grew up in Los Angeles. In 1955, Walt Disney scouted the 12-year-old in a ballet performance, and she got the last of 24 spots on Disney's new TV show. Fans fell immediately in love with the friendly Mouseketeer with the curly black hair. Everyone wanted to be her friend or boyfriend. Judging by the thousands of letters she got each week, fans couldn't get enough. After her series Annette ended, she stayed with Disney making films that included The Shaggy Dog in 1959 and Babes in Toyland in 1961. She wore a large, demure bikini. In the 1960s, Funicello got the go-ahead from Disney to star in teen beach movies, provided they preserved Funicello's clean image. She and co-star Frankie Avalon, who played her boyfriend, surfed, swam, and squabbled in the wholesome series with musical up-and-comers and paper-thin plots. Making records was a logical step. Though she joked that she had only a three-note range, Funicello's songs found an audience. Tall Paul in 1959 and O Dio Mio in 1960 were both top 10 hits. She recorded several albums with plays on her name, like Italianette and Hawaiianette. Her organization helped others. Diagnosed with multiple sclerosis in 1987, Funicello kept her condition private for several years. In 1999, she established a nonprofit foundation, still active today, to research MS and other neurological disorders. American Barman Made Monday Sweet. Kids kept one ear cocked for the sound of the ice cream truck coming down the street, and this is by Josephine Millay of Moraga, California. Every Monday around 3 p.m., some sharp-eared kid would hear bells on the next block and yell, "American Bar is coming!" Kids scrambled in every direction to get a dime as Gus, the ice cream man, drove his sparkling white truck onto Clarendon Drive on Long Island, New York. My dad, Tony, loved ice cream, and Monday was his day off. He'd buy ice cream for any kid who didn't have money. Gus knew a good thing when he saw it and parked his truck right in front of our house. It was the 50s, and Gus, a Greek immigrant, owned his American Bar truck. Painted on the side of the truck were colorful photos of ice cream sandwiches, bars, sundaes, and pops, so that little kids who couldn't read could just point. My mom, Lee, approved of Gus's neatly ironed white pants and starched shirt, black bow tie, and white captain's hat with a black brim. His highly polished black shoes didn't escape her notice either. Gus knew everyone's favorite ice cream. He tried to get me to order something else, but I stuck with vanilla, and my sister Fran always got a sundae cup. My brother Joe got whatever was new and colorful. When I started dating, I was surprised that Gus knew my boyfriend's name. "Joey, what are you doing on this street?" he asked. Years later, our son, another Joe, got to meet the American barman. Gus handed him a vanilla pop, your mama's favorite. Joe was impressed. For his fifth birthday, he asked for a change maker so he could be just like Gus. Our next article is titled, Cold Calls, Family Business Kept Customers on Ice, by David Mamoser of Hamburg, New York. My father, Richard Mamoser, was the local ice man in Hamburg from the late 1940s through the 1960s. The ice business was a family affair for our mom, Laura, and us five kids. Dad worked with several employees, his lifelong friends. When I was 8 or 9, I went with Dad on his regular deliveries. Customers placed an ice card in their windows indicating how much they wanted. They could get 25, 50, or 75 pounds of ice. Dad stopped the truck at each house and placed their order in an oak ice box, then collected payment. Dad delivered to local taverns where, on a hot day, he'd order a draft beer and I'd get an orange soda. They were a dime apiece. He also filled ice machines, and every Sunday around the kitchen table, the whole family counted quarters from the vending machines. We check the date of each coin to see if it should be added to Dad's coin collection. If the fire horn sounded during deliveries, the ice business came to a halt. Dad was also a volunteer fireman in Hamburg. Sometimes my mom had to fill in for Dad and drive the ice truck for the day. In summer, there were additional deliveries. Every year, Dad supplied concession ice for the Buffalo Raceway and the Erie County Fair, where the live fish tanks at the conservation building needed to be kept cool. Dad's base of operation was the ice house at Prospect and Hawkins Avenues, where the ice was made. Tools of the trade were ice picks, holsters, shoulder pads, and ice tongs. The temperature inside the ice house was between 15 and 20 degrees, and even on the hottest days, we wore heavy jackets, red wool shirts, and gloves. In later years, the ice was made elsewhere, and the building was used to store the ice before delivery. The building is now used by the Hamburg Recreation Department, and my great-grandchildren attend summer programs there. In one way or another, the building has been a part of our family for five generations. And from the true love section, silence makes the heart grow fonder. He didn't pay much attention at first. By Terry Hamblin of Mount Juliet, Tennessee. Emma Petty was a quiet girl, and she usually had a book in her hand. She was also pretty, but to be honest, when I went to her house one Saturday afternoon in the summer of 1954, I wasn't expecting to ask her on a date. I wanted to go to a baseball game with her brother, Paul. He wasn't home, so I asked Emma to go with me instead. I found out later through her sisters that she didn't intend to go out with me either. When she disappeared in the house, supposedly to ask her mother's permission, she was looking for an excuse to politely decline. But her mother and sisters convinced her to go out with me and have fun. Our car ride into town was a quiet one. We were both happy not to have to fill the ride with chatter. We didn't mind just sitting together. That was our first date. There wasn't much to do in Mount Juliet, but soon we spent time together however we could. We attended church and more ball games together, and we loved going to the malt shop. We rarely went to the movies. My job paid only 50 cents a day, and the movies cost a quarter. I quickly came to realize that this quiet woman who always had cross-stitch or a new book in her hand was the one I wanted to marry. One day, I sneaked her class ring on my finger so I could figure out the right size for an engagement ring. Before I left for Air Force boot camp, I asked her to marry me. She said, "I have to finish school first." So we waited until she finished school, and then we waited a bit longer because the Air Force trained me on a plane they decided to retire just as I was finishing up schooling on it. Our Thanksgiving wedding was pushed back, but on December 23, 1955, we married. And from our heroes section, harrowing spot on warship, first-hand look at young sailor's life below decks by Steve Carl of Raymond, Maine. My father, Edward Carl, served in the Navy from 1942 to 1946 and was a crew member on the USS Massachusetts, deployed to the Pacific. He was on the crew for a 16-inch gun, the largest weapon on the ship. Since Edward was only 17, his father Charles had to sign the papers that allowed him to enlist, much to the distress of his mother, Ethel. Edward was very skinny and could easily fit through the small hatches, so he was stationed way down on the lower deck where the powder and shells were loaded and sent up to the gun on the top deck via elevators. Being on one of the lower decks meant that he had little chance of survival if the ship was hit. Dad met my mom, Ann, at Old Orchard Beach, Maine, when he and a Navy buddy were on leave. My parents married in 1945 while Dad was still in the Navy. When my dad returned from the service, he tried his hand at a few things and eventually learned steel rule die making. He was one of the few people still practicing the craft in the 60s and 70s. One of his last jobs was assembling CNC milling machines at a company in Hopkinton, Massachusetts. He helped me get a job there, which launched my career as an engineer. Dad always spoke proudly of his time in the service. In 1965, our family was present when the Massachusetts was brought out of mothballs to be restored as a memorial and a museum. I was 9 and remember being so proud. My wife and I have taken our children and grandchildren to see the ship docked in Battleship Cove in Fall River, Massachusetts. Recently, I watched a Navy training film that must have been like what Dad saw when he was trained. I imagine him as a teenager, sitting with other recruits, learning about his assigned role on the ship. Throughout his life, my dad kept in touch with a former crewmate, Jack Becker. They got together every year or so until my dad died in 1996. And from the family tree section, here's an article titled, Irish Union Soldier. Escaping the famine in his homeland, he fought for the North. And this is by Maureen King Cassidy of Oyster Bay, New York. The potato crops in Ireland had several years of failures in the mid-1800s, and in 1845, the Great Famine began to ravage the country. Individuals and entire families left the country by the hundreds of thousands. Many Irish coming to the U.S. were greeted with the notice, "No Irish need apply." One of those immigrants was my ancestor, James Deary, who landed in Brooklyn, New York. James, my great-great-great-uncle, was born in Donegal, Ireland in 1841. He left for the U.S. via Liverpool when he was 9. Like many poor immigrants, he stayed in the place he landed. When the Civil War broke out, James enlisted for the Union, joining the 6th Cavalry Regiment as a private. He was at Gettysburg with his unit on July 3, 1863, the last day of the conflict. James was injured that day and received a monthly pension for the rest of his life. In 1913, he returned to Gettysburg for a reunion of the Union and Confederate soldiers. After the war, he worked for many years for the New York City Fire Department. Over 150 years later, I'm proud that my Irish ancestor participated in the Battle of Gettysburg, which remains one of the bloodiest and most famous battles in U.S. history. And as a side note, here's a little more information about immigrants and the Civil War. Having escaped hardship in their native countries, many immigrants volunteered for military service in America. Hundreds of thousands, especially German and Irish, enlisted in the Union armies. James Deary arrived on the ship, Princeton of New York, with an older man of the same name. What were his thoughts when he came ashore? We know he brought a heritage of love and loyalty and was one of those willing to sacrifice for his adopted country. The National Park Service website confirms Deary was part of the 6th Regiment, U.S. Cavalry. The regiment's motto, led by love of country. At the start of the war, the cavalry was limited to patrolling, scouting, guarding supplies, and escorting officers. However, by 1863, the men were serving as fighters. The 6th Regiment suffered heavy casualties during its time at Gettysburg and Fairfield, Pennsylvania. Steer takes lead at the farm show. His owner learns to pick himself up after a fall, by Donald Moyer of Boyertown, Pennsylvania. Every day for months, I fed, brushed, and combed Scotty, a Black Angus steer. Scotty was my 4-H club project in 1947, and it's hard to describe the close ties that we formed through the daily routine on our farm in Landis Store, Pennsylvania. At the end of that summer, Scotty and I entered the Reading Fair in Berks County, Pennsylvania. We won third place, and so we were invited to the district livestock show in Lancaster. Again, we placed near the top of the show, which entitled us to participate in the big one, the Pennsylvania Farm Show in January 1948. The show is still held today in the state capital, Harrisburg. Everything went smoothly as we arrived at the farm show. Scotty and I prepared for the parade in the arena. He was all washed and brushed, and I was dressed in 4-H show garb, which consisted of a white shirt and white pants. As a 14-year-old, I was mindful of the many young ladies who were all around. I wrapped Scotty's halter strap around my arm, and we lined up to walk into the arena. Suddenly, Scotty took off, pulling me off my feet and dragging me. Talk about embarrassment. This rates as number one. My red face was a contrast with the white uniform covered in black and brown from the arena. That day ended with the auctioning of the animals. One of the top meat companies in the U.S. at that time bought Scotty. Though the tears flowed freely on that day over 70 years ago, I believe my experience in 4-H helped me build a strong base, which led to many successful years as an elementary school principal. Rodeo contests were a barrel of fun. Horse and rider set a fast pace, and this is by Pamela Foster of Lisbon, Ohio. Clarkson, Ohio, where I grew up in the 70s, was the epitome of small-town USA. There was one crossroad, one streetlight on the cement pad where every kid hung out, and everyone knew everything about everybody. My grandfather bought my first pony for my 5th birthday. I remember the ride home like it was yesterday, sitting tall and proud like I owned the world, on Apache, a beautiful, full-blooded Hackney pony. I was in 6th grade when I discovered 4-H. It was heaven for an awkward kid with few friends to find people who were as horse-crazy as I. For several years, I showed Apache, competing in shows every weekend, but the main event was the yearly Columbiana County Fair in Lisbon. Kids from all over converged on a dusty, dirty plot of land laced with gifts from the livestock, straw, mud, and the best and greasiest fair food ever. There were friends to be made, competitions to enter, and baths were non-existent. Apache loved the halter confirmation competitions, which was basically me leading him around the ring and showing off how gorgeous he was. I, however, also wanted to go fast and barrel race, so the last year I competed, I rode my dad's horse, Chandelle. She was a senior quarter horse, but she had no idea older ladies were supposed to be reserved, quiet, and slow. She loved the speed competitions, too, and even though we never won a ribbon, we had a blast. I competed in one class in which riders showcased how well their horses followed leg and bridle cues. I had the great idea to let Chandelle show how quick she was and how tightly she could turn. The next day, an announcement was made that going forward, a rider would be disqualified for stunts like Chandelle and I had pulled. I wonder if that's still a rule today. That was also the year I learned boys were treated differently than girls. It was an unwritten rule that kids could stay in the barns with their horses, and I was so looking forward to it. But shortly before the fair started, the board decided that only boys were allowed to stay in the barns with their animals. I was outraged. With the full support of my parents, I chopped my long hair off and wore hoodies to disguise my appearance so I could room with my buddy. It was a successful ruse, and 4-H taught me, however inadvertently, to stand up for things I believe in. I am so thankful for the time I spent in 4-H. It taught me that not everyone who competes for a trophy will get one, and that shouldn't be the goal anyway. The goal should be to have fun, make friends, and learn about yourself, which I did and continue to do this day. And our next article is from Food Trend, Slices of Wonder, a salute to the loaf that went to pieces. Right from the get-go, Wonder Bread's success was a result of technology and clever marketing, the twin pillars of economic advancement in the first half of the 20th century. The loaf that came to be called Wonder Bread was developed by the Taggart Bacon Company of Indianapolis, Indiana. Taggart was an early pioneer in automated baking, building a factory that was considered state-of-the-art in 1920. It launched Wonder Bread in 1921 after running a series of print ads that talked intriguedly about wonder as something to wonder about. There was no mention of bread, but the unique campaign built mystique for a loaf unlike any other on the market. When it reached stores in May 1921, Each loaf of Wonder Bread was 1.5 pounds, half again as large as other loaves, and with its soft, springy texture, every crumb and bright color, it neither looked nor tasted like the crusty, rustic loaves made at home. Wonder Bread was a marvel of industrial efficiency, a beacon of the modern age. Continental Bacon Company bought Taggart in 1925 and began selling Wonder Bread across the country. In 1930, Continental introduced sliced Wonder Bread. Within a few short years, Wonder Bread was on a roll to becoming a lunchbox staple for generations of school kids. And here's some other interesting facts about Wonder Bread. In 1943, in the midst of a steel shortage, the government banned sliced bread, which was produced using large automated steel slicers. The ban was lifted 2 months later. As Taggart was getting ready to launch its new industrially processed loaf, company executive Elmer Klein was trying to dream up a name for it. At the International Balloon Race in Indianapolis, he found the answer when the sight of all those hot air balloons filled him with wonder. In 2001, Wonder Bread got its own hot air balloon. Perhaps the brand's most successful slogan was, "Make the most of their wonder years," promoting the health benefits of feeding Wonder Bread to kids during the formative years up to age 12. The phrase seeped into the national consciousness. In 1988, writers Neil Marlins and Carol Black borrowed the Wonder Years for the title of their hit sitcom about growing up in 1960s suburbia. Wonder Bread vanished from shelves in 2012 with the bankruptcy of Hostess. But Flowers Foods of Thomasville, Georgia, bought the venerable brand about a year later and has been slowly returning it to stores. To close out today's program, I'm going to share with you some things that were popular in 1958. A car coat. Men and women like this 3/4 length overcoat that makes it easier to slide in and out of 1950s automobiles. DNA. A key historical experiment puts DNA in the news as researchers Matthew Meselson and Franklin Stahl explain how it replicates. Game show. Dotto's star rises, then falls when it's discovered the show is rigged, which leads to scrutiny of other TV game shows. Hairspray. Sales for aerosol-propelled liqueurs soar as the beehive rises to rule the tease bouffants of the late 50s. Launchpad. The first U.S. satellite, Explorer 1, blasts into space from a Cape Canaveral pad. We've run out of time for today's episode of Reminisce. Be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Lisa Maxwell for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Reminisce is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.